My very dear brethren and sisters and young people, in the grace of God, we have been given yet another opportunity to gather together around the Word of God and to contemplate those wondrous things which He has recorded for us. On behalf of the Christadelphian suburban young people of the Adelaide area, I'd like to welcome you to end-of-year studies for 1990. Particularly, I'd like to welcome those from interstate and overseas who have travelled to be with us, and we hope that your stay with us will be both enjoyable and uplifting in the uniting hope that we all share. But especially this evening, I'd like to welcome our brother Roger Lewis from the Christchurch Suburban Ecclesia New Zealand, who will be leading us in a series of studies on the life of Jonathan to the theme, Jonathan, whose love was wonderful. Let us then open our first study this evening with prayer after singing about the great privilege and responsibility which we have in having the Holy Scriptures in hymn 215. I'd like to reiterate our welcome this evening as we come to examine the life of Jonathan around the theme, Jonathan, whose love was wonderful. And this evening, our brother Roger is to speak to us to the title, Jonathan the Warrior, Faithful Courage and Divine Victory. And to prepare our minds for his subject this evening, he's asked that we read from the 1st of Samuel, chapter 14, verses 1 to 23. I'll now call on our brother Nigel Lunn to read for us 1st of Samuel, chapter 14, verses 1 to 23.
Reading with you, the first book of Samuel, chapter 14, verses 1 to 23. Now it came to pass upon a day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the young man that bare his armour, Come, let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. But he told not his father. And Saul tarried in the uttermost part of Gibeah, under a pomegranate tree which is in Migron. And the people that were with him were about 600 men. And Ahai, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, Yahweh's priest in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. And the people knew not that Jonathan was gone. And between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over onto the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on the one side and a sharp rock on the other side. And the name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other, Sina. The forefront of the one was situate northward over against Michmash, and the other southward over against Gibeah. And Jonathan said unto the young man that bare his armour, Come, and let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that Yahweh will work for us. For there is no restraint to Yahweh to save by many or by few. And his armor-bearer said unto him, Do all that is in thine heart. Turn thee. Behold, I am with thee according to thy heart. Then said Jonathan, Behold, we will pass over unto these men, and we will discover ourselves unto them. If they say thus unto us, Tarry until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place, and will not go up unto them. But if they say unto they say thus, Come up unto us, then we will go up, for Yahweh hath delivered them into our hands. And this shall be a sign unto us. And both of them discovered themselves unto the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, Behold, the Hebrews come forth out of the holes where they have hid themselves. And the men of the garrison answered Jonathan and his armor-bearer and said, Come up to us, and we will show you a thing. And Jonathan said unto his armor-bearer, Come up after me, for Yahweh hath delivered them into the hand of Israel. And Jonathan climbed up upon his hands and upon his feet, and his armor-bearer after him. And they fell before Jonathan, and his armor-bearer slew after him. And that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor-bearer made was about 20 men, within, as it were, an half acre of land, which a yoke of oxen might plough. And there was a trembling in the host, in the field, and among all the people, the garrison and the spoilers, they also trembled, and the earth quaked. So it was a very great trembling. And the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away, and they went on, beating down one another. Then said Saul unto the people that were with him, Number now, and see who is gone from us. And when they had numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor-bearer were not there. And Saul said unto Hai, Bring hither the ark of God. The ark of God was at that time with the children of Israel. And it came to pass, while Saul talked unto the priest, that the noise that was in the host of the Philistines went on and increased. And Saul said unto the priest, Withdraw thine hand. And Saul and all the people that were with him assembled themselves, and they came to the battle, and behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was a very great discomfiture. Moreover, the Hebrews that were with the Philistines before that time, which went up with them into the camp from the country round about, even they also turned to be with the Israelites that were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel that had hid themselves in Mount Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, then even they also followed hard after them in the battle. So Yahweh saved Israel that day, and a battle passed over unto Beth-Aven.
I'd like to call upon our brother Roger to lead us in the first study, Jonathan the Warrior, Faithful Courage and Divine Victory.
Well, Brother Chairman, my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ, and especially at this time to our dear young people, of whom I certainly see a great number spread out in front of me as the sand of the sea by way of multitude. And that's a phrase, of course, that's going to occur in the record of Jonathan's exploits as we're going to come across him this evening. Well, brothers and sisters and young people, in the providence of God, we've been given opportunity again that we might come together and give our minds and our hearts to the good things of divine truth. And by way of exhortation over the course of these end-of-year studies, we wish to give our mind to the life and to the story of Jonathan. I suppose he's one of those men, in a sense, that become overshadowed by the greatness of the man that was to follow him, David, the man after God's own heart. And yet, in a very real way, we're going to find that Jonathan's character at the time in the divine narrative that he stands alongside David, that Jonathan's character shines out with a greater strength and a greater decisiveness in the truth than does David's. And yet, for all of that, for all of the fact that the divine record clearly shows Jonathan to be a more mature man in the truth than David, it is Jonathan that's going to give himself in loving loyalty to his young friend. You may have realized by the title to this series that that indeed is going to be the burden of our studies in the main. The loving loyalty of Jonathan to David. Jonathan, whose love was wonderful. You know, his name means given of Yahweh. And so he was. Because he was a man in a very special and unique sense that was given to David. And as such, he stands as a prototype of the disciples who were given to Christ. You'll remember that in the Lord's Prayer of John 17, that on seven occasions the Lord refers to those whom thou hast given me, he says. Seven times in John 17. Those whom thou hast given me, in reference to his disciples. And concerning those disciples, in that same chapter, he prays to his Father that they might be one with him. And if ever there was a prototype of the disciples being one with the Lord, it's found in the life circumstances of Jonathan, given of Yahweh to David, and knit together in loyal love to his friend. And this evening, by way of introduction, what we want to do is to go back into the record to the 14th chapter and to take but one of three great events in Jonathan's life before he ever meets up with David, in order to have a grasp of the measure of the spirit of this man with whom we are to deal. In the 1st of Samuel chapter 14, as we've had it read together in the first 23rd verses, we have the story of that marvelous exploit of the climbing of the cliff and the overthrowing of the garrison of the Philistines. This is but one of three stories recorded concerning this man before David comes into the divine record. And yet we want to take it this evening as illustrative of the spirit of Jonathan's life as a whole. Now, one or two words then with regard to the background to the story. The background. Here's the first point. In the 1st of Samuel chapter 13 and verses 13 and 14, the divine record says that Samuel said to Saul, "Thou hast done foolishly. Thou hast not kept the commandment of Yahweh thy God which he commanded thee. For now would Yahweh have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever. But now thy kingdom shall not continue. Yahweh hath sought him a man after his own heart, and Yahweh hath commanded him to be captain over his people, because thou hast not kept that which Yahweh commanded thee." You know, brothers and sisters and young people, the 1st of Samuel chapter 13 is about the marvelous victory of Jonathan smiting the garrison of the Philistines. Verse 3. And in the very chapter where he wins a signal victory for the truth, he finds in verses 13 and 14 that he has forever lost his right to the kingdom because of the disobedience of his father. He has forever lost his right to the kingdom. You see what verse 13 says? Now would Yahweh have established thy kingdom upon Israel forever. How would Saul's kingdom be established forever? Was he to be made immortal? Of course not. It would be established forever in the generations to follow Saul, of whom the first would be Jonathan. And verse 14 says, "But now thy kingdom shall not continue." And in those words, in the 14th verse, they're marked, my dear brothers and sisters and young people, not only the cessation of Saul's rule, but the overthrow of the entire line of the house of Saul. And Jonathan, in this chapter, who has demonstrated marvelous faith, has now lost the right to the throne in favor of another man who is yet to appear upon the divine stage. How do you think Jonathan would feel about that? You know, royal sons were groomed up to expect that right at some stage. How do you think Jonathan felt about that? And here's the second point. In the 17th verse of the 1st of Samuel 13, we're told that spoilers came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned unto the way that leadeth to Ophrah, into the land of Shual. And another company turned away to Beth Horon, and another company turned to the way of the border that looketh to the valley of Zeboim, towards the wilderness. There came spoilers out of the camp of the Philistines. Do you know what the spoilers were? They were raiding parties designed to undermine the morale of the people of Israel. And they're all over the place. There's some here, there's some there, there's some somewhere else. raiding parties from the Philistines, making inroads all over the land of Israel. And then we're told, in the 21st and 22nd verses, that they had a file in those days for their mattocks and for their coulters and for their forks and for their axes and to sharpen the goads. But it came to pass, as far as the day of battle was concerned, that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and Jonathan, but with Saul and Jonathan his son was there found. There were no swords or spears in the whole of Israel, apart from that which the king and his son had. And not only that, but in chapter 13 in verse 6, we're told that when the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were distressed, then the people did hide themselves in caves and in thickets and in rocks and in high places and in pits, and some of the Hebrews went over Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. So a great deal of the army has deserted. How many? Well, verse 2 tells us, that Saul chose them 3,000 men of Israel. But by the time we get to verse 15, Saul numbers the people that were present, and there's only 600 left. So 2,400 men of the army have disappeared into holes. Now that's the background of chapter 14. Just think about that again. Saul has lost the kingdom. Jonathan's lost his right to the throne. The land is besieged by the raiding parties of the Philistines. There's no weapons to fight a battle. Most of the army has deserted. The whole cause of Israel is hopeless. And chapter 14 and verse 1 says, "Now it came to pass upon a day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the young man that bare his armor, Come and let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side." And so here is a man, you see, that despite the impossible situation, is prepared to show tremendous courage in the truth. Jonathan was a man who always wanted to stand up for the truth. It didn't matter to him what the circumstances were. The nation as a whole must have been gripped with despair at this time. He says, "Come and let us go." Now, this is the man who's just lost the right to sit upon the royal throne. Why should he take that risk in chapter 14, verse 1? Why should he of all men in this land take the risk of losing his life? Apart from the fact that he loved the truth, and he wanted to make a stand for it. And so he says unto the young man that bear his armor, "Come and let us go over to the Philistines' garrison." It doesn't say why, but he certainly wasn't going for sightseeing. And he certainly didn't intend to have any discussions. The sole objective of going over to the Philistines' garrison was that he intended to destroy them. And we're told that in the 6th verse. As far as Jonathan was concerned, there was a need for someone to make a stand in this matter. And the end of verse 1, oh, what a significant phrase, "he told not his father." Now, why do you think the divine record tells us that he told not his father? And I think, you know, that when you read this particular passage carefully, it seems to be implying that there is already a growing gulf between father and son. He's been very close to his father, has this son. But he's already seen the signs of that which is wrong in his father. And there's a difference in thinking between these two men. He told not his father. And that gulf is deliberately highlighted in the next 2 to 4 verses as the attitudes of these two men are contrasted. We're told in the 2nd verse that Saul tarried in the uttermost part of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree, which is in Migron, and the people that were with him were about 600 men, And Ahiah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, Yahweh's priest in Shiloh, wearing an ephod, and the people knew not that Jonathan was gone. So verse 1, Jonathan says, come and let us go over. Verse 2, and Saul tarried in the uttermost part of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree. You know, the word tarried there means to dwell, to remain, to settle down. And that's exactly what Saul intended to do. He intended to settle down under the pomegranate tree whilst he thought long and hard about his next move. And it says specifically in the second verse that he dwelt in the uttermost part of Gibeah. Actually, the word has been rendered the outskirts. Now, why would it specifically tell us that Saul was dwelling on the outskirts of Gibeah? Unless the implication of the narrative is that it just happened to be that the outskirts were as far away from the Philistines as possible. And he's sitting under a pomegranate tree. You know, the pomegranate is a symbol of the whole house of Israel, redeemed in Christ and resting in the joys of the kingdom age. But the kingdom hasn't come yet, and there's battles yet to be fought. And Saul has not appreciated what his responsibility as king is in this matter. And the people that were with him, verse 2, were about 600 men, and Ahiah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, the son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, Yahweh's priest in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. So he's got a priest with him, has he? You'll notice that the margin quite correctly calls him not Ahiah, verse 3, but Ahimelech, as he is later to be known in the divine record. Why do you think we're told that Saul has a priest with him? Perhaps it was a reaction to the fact that Samuel was gradually withdrawing his influence and his contact from Saul. And Saul felt that. In fact, in the very next chapter, in chapter 15, Samuel is going to turn on his heel and will speak never again with Saul for the rest of his life. And so Saul senses that withdrawal of Samuel from him. So he gets him a priest. There's a token, if you like, of religious influence in Saul's life. But the token of religious influence in Saul's life was never deep enough, of course, to really influence him according to divine principles. And the man that he has as priest is the very man in a later chapter who he's going to slay in a fit of rage because that man had shown kindness to David. Now verse 4 says that between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over under the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on the one side and a sharp rock on the other side, and the name of the one was Bozez and the name of the other Sinner, and the forefront of the one was situate northward over against Michmash and the other southward over against Gibeah. You know, it's a funny thing when you actually look at this, because what we're being told here in these two verses is that here are two entire verses devoted to describing two rocks. That's pretty interesting, isn't it? Two rocks. Why would you devote two verses to the explanation of two rocks in the Bible unless they were of significance, as well they might be? Now you see in verse 4 it says, between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over unto the Philistines' garrison. The New International Version says, on each side of the pass that Jonathan intended to cross to reach the Philistine outpost. And of course, what we're being told in verses 4 and 5 is that this area is characterized by very deep flowing wadis which cut through the Judean plateau. And in this very region between Gibeah and Michmash are two such deep flowing wadis. And the reference to the two sharp rocks here is a reference, in fact, to two sides of the wadi with two parts of the wadi jutting out into the wadi floor itself. And this first one, it says, is called Bozez. Now the word Bozez means literally fine white linen. And we have a series of references there. In fact, those are the only other Bible passages where that word occurs. It's only ever used of this rock and of that fine white linen. It is a unique word in terms of its usage. Now, the interesting thing about those passages is that those instances of the use of fine white linen there are connected with only one specific incident in the divine record. The fine white linen there is always related, if it's related to anything at all, to the bringing of the ark of God's presence in among his people. Let's go and have a look perhaps just at one example of that. The first of Chronicles chapter 15. The first of Chronicles chapter 15 and verse 27. Here's just one of the three times where that word is used in this connection. In the first of Chronicles chapter 15 and verse 27, perhaps verse 25 for connection, it says, "So David and the elders of Israel and the captains over thousands went to bring up the ark of the covenant of Yahweh out of the house of Obed-Edom with joy. And it came to pass when God helped the Levites that bear the ark of the covenant of Yahweh, that they offered seven bullocks and seven rams, and David was clothed with a robe of fine linen, and all the Levites that bear the ark." In other words, they also were clothed with a robe of fine linen. Now, that's the word used here, fine linen. And the ones that are wearing that linen are those that are bearing the ark of God's holy presence amongst his people. The same word is used later on in the second of Chronicles at the time that Solomon brings the ark into the holy place. And on another occasion, it tells us that it's the same fine white linen that was the veil standing in front of the Most Holy. So it's not just a symbol of righteousness. It's a symbol of the righteousness of those amongst whom God's holy presence presides. And that's the name of this rock, back in the first of Samuel chapter 14. And if you come back to that chapter, the first of Samuel 14, and verse 4, it says, "There was a sharp rock on the one side and a sharp rock on the other side, and the name of the one was Bozez, and the name of the other, Senur, and the forefront of the one was situate northward over against Michmash." And so we've made the assumption here on the overhead before you that here we have the sharp rock that is situate northward over against Michmash, pointing to the north. It's a sharp part of the wadi that juts out into the Wadi Valley. Now, what about the other one? Well, the name of the other rock, according to this record, is Senur. Now, that's an interesting word as well, because it likewise is used in a unique connection in Scripture. It's only found here, describing the rock of the wadi, and the only other way in which it's used is to describe the bush of divine manifestation that Moses saw burning in Exodus chapter 2. Now, you know what the bush represents, don't you? We say that the bush represents the Israel of God that burns but is never consumed. But you know, it means more than that. If you come to Deuteronomy chapter 33, which is one of those references there, and those, incidentally, in the Old Testament are the only other references to this word Senur. In Deuteronomy chapter 33, and verse 16, here's what the bush represents, we believe, in the context of these two rocks. Deuteronomy 33, verse 16 says, "And for the precious things of the earth and fullness thereof, and for the goodwill of him that dwelt in the bush." That's what the bush symbolizes. Not just that Israel will never be consumed, but that the reason why Israel will never be consumed is because in the bush dwells the presence of God. And if the bush represents Israel, then the burning bush represents God's glorious presence amidst his people. And if you go to those New Testament references in the Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of Luke and Acts chapter 7, you'll find that the narrative very clearly lays stress on that factor concerning the bush. It was the place of the presence of God's dwelling amidst his people. Now those are the two words used to describe these two rocks, and here we have it. And so here we have the wadi, as it were, running between the middle, and these two rocks that jut out into the wadi. Now come back to the 1st of Samuel chapter 14. Now you notice what the divine record says here. It says in verse 5 that the forefront of the one, and as the margin correctly says, the word in the Hebrew means the tooth. The tooth of the one was situate northward, and the tooth of the other southward. Sometimes we tend to depict these two rocks as great crags towering up to a pinnacle at the top. No such thing. They were both a tooth in the sense of a sharp point, but the sharp point ran horizontally, not vertically. The sharp point of one ran as a tooth out northwards, and the sharp tooth of the other ran as a point southwards over against Gibeah. They were the two crags here that fell away from the top of the wadi down into the wadi valley below. And it's down into that precipitous region that Jonathan now intends to go. Now, you know, the interesting thing about those two rocks is this, that Saul at this very moment has a man with a fine linen ephod of divine communication with the presence of God. But he can't see the lesson of those two rocks. And he can't bring himself to believe that God's presence is sufficient to save his people. But Jonathan can. And Jonathan really believed that. And Jonathan looked at those two rocks and he said, you know, those two rocks tell me that if God's presence is with us, then we must be able to gain victory over the Philistines. I believe that, says Jonathan. Now you see what the sixth verse says. And Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armour. But Rotahim translates the phrase, so Jonathan said to the young man. And the word so there, as it in being rendered in that way, tells us that Jonathan looked at the rocks, pondered their significance, and so he then said to the young man, come and let us go. He believed that God's presence would be with them. Now you notice that verse 6 is almost identical to verse 1. We're told in verse 6 that Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armour, come and let us go over unto the garrison. That's the same as verse 1. And what that tells us, therefore, by way of implication, is that verses 2, 3, 4, and 5 are in parenthesis to give us the background to Jonathan's statement. The one explanation is in order that he might be contrasted with his father, and the other in order that the true significance of this occasion, and particularly of the nature of the terrain, might be explained to us before Jonathan makes his move. And so in verse 6 he says to the young man, come and let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. You know what Jonathan was really saying? He says, if this is Yahweh's land, and this is Yahweh's people, and those two rocks there in front of us have both got Hebrew names that remind us of Yahweh's presence upon his people. And if these men here are uncircumcised, that is, they have no covenant relationship with Yahweh, then they must be the aliens, not us. And we will be able to overcome them. Isn't that what he's saying? And so indeed, the record goes on to say, it may be that Yahweh will work for us, for there is no restraint to Yahweh to save by many or by few. And few there were indeed, when out of 600 men, only one and his armor bearer were to go forth. And the seventh verse says that his armor bearer said unto him, do all that is in thine heart, turn thee, behold, I'm with thee according to thy heart. Now, it was a very dangerous journey, wasn't it? To scale down one of those crags down into the valley floor and to attempt to scale up the other side. And yet, despite that, this armour bearer, when Jonathan postulated his suggestion, says, "Do all that is in thine heart, turn thee, behold, I'm with thee according to thy heart." Now, do you think that the armour bearer of Jonathan said that out of a sense of duty? Do you think that he said what he said simply because he needed to be obedient as a servant to the prince? No, the armour bearer obviously wasn't moved by that consideration, was he? The reason for the armour bearer's response was that he'd had contact with Jonathan before. And his relationship with this man had produced a deep impression upon him. He had implicit confidence in Jonathan. Jonathan was a man who inspired confidence in others. It's one of the qualities that he had. He inspired confidence in other people. Do all that is in thine heart. I am with thee. The armour bearer wasn't a leader, was he? He was going to be one of those men in the truth that would be a supporter, a follower, a backer up, a provider of help. But he's so totally supportive of Jonathan, he says, "Well, look," he says, "I don't know how we're going to get down. And I don't know how we're going to cross the valley floor, and I haven't got a clue how we're going to get up the other side, but if you think we can do it, I'm with you according to your heart, and I'll carry your armour wherever you want to go." What a tremendous spirit that was. And what a tremendous character Jonathan must have had to have elicited that sort of response from his armour bearer. You know, there's always room in the truth, isn't there, for people like that. We're not all Jonathans. Very few of us are really Jonathans. There's actually no need for a whole ecclesia of Jonathans. But there's an awful lot of room for armour bearers, isn't there? Plenty of opportunity for us to say, "Do all that's in thine heart, I'm with thee," and there we are, supporting what work is done. It might be others that have taken the initiative, others that lead the way. It's a question of whether we're prepared to bear their armour, you see. Verse 8 says, "Jonathan said, Behold, we will pass over unto these men, and we will discover ourselves unto them. And if they say thus unto us, Tarry until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and will not go up unto them. But if they say thus, Come up unto us, then we will go up, for Yahweh hath delivered them into our hand, and this shall be a sign unto us." Now look very carefully at what Jonathan says in verses 8, 9 and 10 concerning a sign. He says, look, I tell you what we'll do. He says, we'll go and discover ourselves unto these men. If they say, come up, if they say, tarry until we come to you, then we'll stand still and we won't do a thing. We certainly won't go up to them. But if they say, come up, then we will go up and we'll take that as a sign that Yahweh has delivered them into our hand. You know, there's an interesting thing about that statement, isn't there? The terms of the sign that Jonathan proposed here were couched in a way that were likely to be fulfilled, but at the most risk to themselves. It was the hardest possible way for them that sign could be outworked. Far easier if the sign was, well, if they come down to us, then we'll wait and we'll get some of the army together and we'll help to overthrow them. No, the sign that Jonathan proposed was that which was the most likely to be fulfilled, but which entailed the greatest risk to their own lives. Is that the sort of signs that we give ourselves in the truth? Sometimes we ask for signs, don't we, as to whether we should go forward in some matter. But it's not often that we set for ourselves the sign that will be the hardest for us to achieve. We don't normally do that, do we? Jonathan did. Verse 11 says, both of them discovered themselves unto the garrison of the Philistines. The word discovered means literally to make naked. They exposed themselves to ridicule. They exposed themselves to contempt. They exposed themselves to whatever danger might come upon them. And they got all of those things Because we're told, certainly as far as the ridicule is concerned in verse 11, that the Philistines said, "Behold, the Hebrews come forth out of the holes where they hid themselves." And the men of the garrison answered Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, "Come up to us and we will show you a thing or two." And Jonathan immediately said to his armor bearer, "Come up. The Yahweh hath delivered them into the hand of Israel." Yahweh hath delivered them into the hand of Israel. Not the hand of Jonathan, the hand of Israel. You see, Jonathan wasn't a man who was particularly worried about the fact that he might accomplish this particular job. What concerned him was that this was Yahweh's work for Yahweh's people, for the deliverance of his nation, and that these people would be delivered into the hand of Israel. Now look by way of contrast at the spirit of his father, verse 24. "And the men of Israel were distressed that day, for Saul had adjured the people, saying, 'Cursed be the man that eateth any food until evening, that I may be avenged on mine enemies.'" There's the spirit of his father. "I want vengeance on mine enemies." Jonathan said, "They're not our enemies, they're Yahweh's enemies, and it's his battle, and he's delivered them into the hands of Israel." What a marvelous spirit that was. With a wholehearted spirit, wasn't it, that always put the truth first. And verse 13 says that Jonathan climbed up upon his hands and upon his feet, and his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan. The word "climbed up" in verse 13 is the same word translated "come up after me" in verse 12. It means literally to ascend, and so it was. They ascended in every sense of the word. They ascended in faith and courage before their God when they made this climb. It was truly an ascent in every sense. What do you think it felt like? Climbing up the face. It's almost too hard to imagine, isn't it? Can you see him there? How do you think they felt on that occasion? Fingers blistered and scratched. Feet sliding on rocks, breaking away for them and tumbling into the valley floor below. Muscles aching as they strove to obtain footholds and toeholds and handholds to keep shaking body pressed close to the rock. Mouth dry. Heart pounding away. Pounding so loud that they could probably not hear anything else, drowning out all other things, roaring in their ears. All of their physical energies devoted to that difficult and dangerous climb, so that they would be exhausted before they'd ever got to the top of the climb, let alone have any energy or strength left to then deal with the Philistines that might be there. Scaling the wall. And when they got there, what would await them at the top? It was a marvellous exploit, wasn't it? A marvellous, marvellous exploit. You know why he did it, brothers and sisters? Young people? Because he believed in the lesson of the rocks. He implicitly believed in the lesson of the rocks. God's presence is with his people. And I'll tell you why he did it. Joshua chapter 23. Here's the spirit of why he made that climb. Here's the thought of Jonathan as he struggled up that face. Joshua chapter 23, verses 6 to 11. "And Joshua himself in old age says, 'Be ye therefore very courageous to keep and to do all that's written in the book of the law of Moses, that ye turn not aside therefrom to the right hand or to the left, that ye come not among these nations, these that remain among you, neither make mention of the name of their gods,
nor cause to swear by them, neither serve them, nor bow yourselves unto them, but cleave unto Yahweh your God as you've done this day. Don't have anything to do with the surrounding nations. Jonathan says, let's go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Do you think he had anything to do with the surrounding nations? Verse 9, for Yahweh hath driven out from before you great nations and strong, but as for you, no man hath been able to stand before you unto this day. One man of you shall chase a thousand. But Yahweh your God, he it is that fighteth for you, as he hath promised you. Take good heed therefore unto yourselves, that ye love Yahweh your God. One man shall chase a thousand, for Yahweh shall fight for you. And that thought must have rung in Jonathan's ears as he clambered up that mountainside, encouraging his armor bearer behind. How do you think Jonathan felt knowing that he'd asked that armor bearer to follow him into what might be certain death? What faith he had to ask his armor bearer to follow him in that context. Yahweh will fight for us, and one of us will chase away a thousand. I believe that, says Jonathan. You know, there's lots of opportunities and lots of times in life where we need to be prepared to climb that particular mountain. Sometimes it's a problem at school or a problem at work. Some issue that we have with someone outside in the world. Might be something they've asked us to do. And it involves a compromise of divine principles, and we worry about whether we should do something about it and say something about it or not. And we find it every bit as hard as the climb of Jonathan as he climbed up that rock face, don't we? And we walk to and fro. We find that our hands go all cold and clammy, and our heart begins to pound, and we're not sure whether we should do it. We go up and down, and we change our mind. And what we're really saying is that we're finding that cliff face is awfully high to climb. But you've got to do it, if there's a principle of the truth at stake. And sometimes there are times, aren't there, when we have to make a stand with someone who's out there, who is, after all, only an uncircumcised Philistine, no matter what position they might have in the world, and to say, look, I'm sorry, but this is wrong, and we don't agree with this principle, and I'm sorry, but I can't do that. And the moment you've got it out, and you've made your stand, and you feel as if you've said your piece, well, you feel as if you've scaled a precipice. Maybe that is what you've done. Or it might be the planning of some activity in ecclesial life, the handling of a series of special lectures, or the bringing together of the circumstances for a special effort. And there are all sorts of obstacles, aren't there? Mountains to climb, and people that don't want us to climb them. You know, brothers and sisters, we all need in the ecclesia lots of people that know how to climb cliffs. And it won't be any easier for us. See what verse 13 says when they got to the top. They fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer slew after him. You know, they must have been a formidable couple, these two, because when you actually look at the Hebrew text, what it implies, in fact, this is how Green translates the text. He says, and they fell before Jonathan, his armor bearer giving the death blow behind him. So when they got to the top, they dusted off their hands, had a look at what was around, walked forward, Jonathan taps the first bloke on the shoulder, whack, down on the ground, in comes his armor bearer behind him, death blow. On to the next one, whack, they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer finishes them off. One by one by one by one, they must have been a formidable team, those two men. They walked through that Philistine rank, one after the other. And verse 14 says, that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men. That's not too bad. That's 10 to 1 odds. Within, as it were, an half acre of land which a yoke of oxen might plough. But the margin gives a better translation. Within half a furrow of an acre of land. Now a furrow, of course, was generally ploughed by two oxen. And if you imagine that what we have here is a sharp piece of rock that juts out into the wadi, the width of that piece of rock was about the width of what a furrow could be made by two oxen ploughing along its length. It was a long, narrow piece of rock projecting out into the wadi. And they climb up on the tip of that, and they go marching down that narrow strip, and they successfully slaughter 20 men as they come down through that narrow strip of ground. It was a remarkable exhibition. But you know what must have filled them with tremendous anxiety as they came down along that piece of rock? Was that although they had slain 20 men, that this was but the command post for 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and people by the sand of the seashore for multitude, which all lay beyond that garrison. Now, how are they going to take that lot on? We got through the first 20, but that's only the command post of an innumerable multitude that lies behind. Now, how did they ever think they were going to cope with that lot? But it was a wonderful spirit, wasn't it? And we're told in the 15th verse that God was pleased to answer the faith of his servant Jonathan on this occasion. Record says there was a trembling in the host. Now just look at the way that the tension builds up in the 15th verse. I'm going to read it a slightly different way. This is really what verse 15 is saying, isn't it? There was a trembling. There was a trembling in the host. There was a trembling in the field. There was a trembling among the people. There was a trembling in the garrison. There was a trembling amidst the spoilers. There was a trembling with the earth. So there was a very great trembling. You see the build-up of the magnitude of verse 15. As God Almighty finally thunders his response of approval to the magnificent faith of Jonathan on this occasion. And we're reminded of the words of Psalm 18, which we won't turn up, but I'll read for you in the 7th verse. Then the earth shook and trembled, the foundations also of the hills moved and were shaken, because he was wroth. And God Almighty answered the faithfulness of his servant on this occasion. In fact, the literal Hebrew here, when it says there was a very great trembling, is literally Ragaz Elohim, the quivering of the mighty one. Ragav is the root word from where the Greek word Boanerges comes, the sons of thunder. It must have been a dreadful episode for all concerned, and no less so for Jonathan himself, as they stand up there on that narrow spit of rock, working their way steadily through the men, and all of a sudden the whole precipice begins to shake and to tremble. And Jonathan himself must have been filled with fear as Yahweh vindicated his faith. And you know what God really did in verse 15? He lifted the whole battle out of Jonathan's hands and took it over. It is Yahweh thy God that fighteth for thee, said Joshua 23. And we never need to forget, should never forget that, should we? Whatever we might have done, and however significant we think it might be, it is actually Yahweh's battle. And he won it that day. Just to remind even Jonathan that he was but an instrument for the fulfillment and the outworking of God's purpose. Verse 16 says, the watchmen of Saul in Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away. Isn't that a lovely phrase? They melted away. And they went on beating down one another. And Saul said unto the people that were with him, number now and see who's gone from us. And when they'd numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. You know, when Saul said in verse 17, number the people that we might see who's gone from us, one gains the impression that perhaps Saul already suspected that Jonathan was involved. There's something funny, say the watchers, there's something funny going on in the host of the Philistines. It looks as if they're melting away. Number the people, says Saul. I'm sure my son's at the bottom of this. Oh, he knew Jonathan, his son, didn't he? But what Saul really wanted to know was, how many of my men has my son taken with him on this foolish mission? And he was astonished to find when the people were numbered But Jonathan was the only one not there. And his armor bearer, who of course would have been with him in any event. Verse 18 says, that Saul said unto Ahimelech, bring hither the ark of God. But the Septuagint translation renders the phrase, bring hither the ephod. For he wore the ephod at that time before Israel. And that cross-references us, of course, back to the third verse when it says that Ahimelech was there, Yahweh's priest in Shiloh, wearing an ephod. And it was the ephod, we believe, that Saul asked Ahimelech to bring forth rather than the ark. We believe the Septuagint translation to be correct in this particular matter. And one of the reasons why we believe it was correct was because in the 19th verse it says that it came to pass while Saul talked unto the priest that the noise that was in the host of the Philistines went on and increased, and Saul said unto the priest, withdraw thine hand. Now he wouldn't have his hand in the ark, would he? But he certainly would have had his hand in the ephod, because the ephod was a pocket. Specifically told that in the matter of its construction, the book of Exodus. And the hand was in the ephod. But before the priest could determine what it was that needed to be determined, Saul says, withdraw thine hand. Because he can't make up his mind. First of all, he's dwelling under a pomegranate, and he's got a priest, but he's not prepared to believe in the power of God. Now that something appears to be happening, he thinks, well, maybe we ought to get the priest involved. And by the time he gets the priest involved, the noise is so loud in verse 19 that he, having got the priest underway in the matter of Urim and Thummim and the ephod, he then says, no, take your hand out. We haven't got any time. You see, he never really was religious, was he, Saul? He's filled with indecision and doubt. The religious side of Saul is only ever a token and a pretense. It's never real. It's never ever changed his heart. And verse 20 says, and Saul and all the people that were with him assembled themselves, and they came to the battle, and behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was a very great discomfiture. You know, sometimes the authorized version is splendid, isn't it? Every man's sword was against his fellow, and as a result of that, no doubt there was a very great discomfiture. And so it was. And now Saul and all the people that were with him, verse 20, have rallied themselves to the battle, the 600 men that were left. But it wasn't just those men, because verse 21 says, moreover, the Hebrews that were with the Philistines before that time, that is, those which were slaves of the Philistines, as the Septuagint translation reveals, which went up with them into the camp from the country round about, even they also turned to be with the Israelites that were with Saul and Jonathan. And verse 22 says, likewise, all the men of Israel which had hid themselves in Mount Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, even they also followed hard after them in the battle. Now you'll remember that the men of verse 22 which hid themselves are referred to back in chapter 13. How many hid themselves? 2,400 men, according to chapter 13, verse 2, 6, and 15. So you see what's really happened here when we consider together verse 20, 21, and 22. What we're really being told in these verses is that faith and courage in just one person can stir up a nation. And all those who had left the truth rejoined it because of the faithful exploits of Jonathan. On that day, brothers and sisters and young people, in one move, he inspired 3,000 men in that ecclesia to action. Isn't that a good lesson? Everyone in an ecclesia can contribute to the exalting of that ecclesia and the lifting up of its standards by personal acts of faith and dedication. That's a powerful lesson, isn't it, here from the life of Jonathan? The faithful example of one. And its ability to enthuse and inspire others that their own standard of dedication in the truth might be lifted up. And so verse 23 says, so Yahweh saved Israel that day, and the battle passed over unto Bethel. You see what it says? So Yahweh saved Israel that day. Not Jonathan. No matter how faithful Jonathan was, it was God's victory. But he was pleased to grant that victory, divine victory, because of the faithful courage of his servant. And whilst we believe that we don't have any Philistine garrisons to overthrow in our own day, there's still lots of uncircumcised people out there, aren't there? And we must believe that God is able to save Israel in our own day if we're prepared to show the same faithful courage as did John. Now, you know, there's a background to this story that we want to just consider together by way of conclusion this evening. Do you know that this story in the 1st of Samuel 14 is rooted in a set of earlier circumstances in the divine record? You see, if you come to the story of Gideon, we find that we've got an overhead there that shows us that here was the words of Gideon when he was appointed to office. In Judges chapter 6 and verse 15, the record says that Gideon said, O my Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is poor in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house. And yet despite that, we're told in Judges chapter 6 and verse 34, but the Spirit of Yahweh came upon Gideon. And so it did. And thus, mightily empowered, he was to win a signal victory. And Judges 7 verse 16 says that he divided the 300 men that he had into three companies that the host of the Midianites might be slain. But before he slew them, we're told in chapter 7 and verse 19, so Gideon and the men came unto the outside of the camp of the Midianites in the beginning of the middle watch. And finally, as a result of that marvelous victory, when the people of Israel said to Gideon, why don't you reign over us? He told them in Judges 8 verse 23, he said, I neither my son shall rule over you, for Yahweh shall rule over you. And what he was really saying is that it was Yahweh's victory in the battle against the Midianites, not mine. All right? Now let's have a look at Saul. In the 1st of Samuel chapter 9 and verse 21, when Samuel appoints him to office, he says, am not I a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? I wonder where Saul got that idea from. You know, you sort of imagine that Saul's words were filled with humility. They were actually very deliberate words that told everyone in Israel that as far as Saul was concerned, his hero was Gideon. And Saul liked to think that he modelled himself on the heroic exploits of his forebear, who had lived, of course, not too much earlier before him in the times of the judges. And the victory of Gideon was such an enormous one that the nation had certainly not forgotten about it by the time we come to Saul. And Saul's answer there, as Samuel appoints him, is couched in terms that leaves us in no doubt that he says, I'm going to be the Gideon of my time against the Philistines. That's me, says Saul. In the 1st of Samuel, chapter 11 and verse 6, it does say, and the Spirit of God came upon Saul. So there was a measure of similarity. And on the occasion of the first battle that Saul had, we're told in the 1st of Samuel, chapter 11 and verse 11, and it was so on the morrow that Saul put his people into three companies. I wonder why Saul did that. He was marching against Nahash the Ammonite in order to assist the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead, and he forced his army to march all night, and I believe that he did so in order that they might arrive by the time of the middle watch following Gideon, but they didn't quite make it, because the 1st of Samuel chapter 11 verse 11 says, and they came into the midst of the host in the morning watch, that's the watch after the middle, and slew the Ammonites until the heat of day. And that would be typical of Saul. He never ever did quite make it after that which he was endeavouring to copy. And yet there was a spirit of similarity there, wasn't there? And you know, as a result of that signal victory, the first battle that Saul ever won, we're told in the 1 Samuel chapter 11 and verse 13, and Saul said, not a man shall be put to death, for today Yahweh hath wrought salvation in Israel. Now you know, when you look at that, you're impressed with the fact that Saul modelled himself on the life of Gideon. He said, he's my hero, and I'm going to be the Gideon against the Philistines in my own day. Now come back to the 1 Samuel chapter 13. The 1 Samuel chapter 13. Verse 5. And the Philistines gathered themselves together to fight with Israel. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude. Now in your margins you'll see that final phrase, people as the sand which is on the seashore in multitude, is cross-reference to Joshua chapter 11, verse 4. But in the context, it doesn't refer back to Joshua. It refers back to Judges chapter 7, verse 12. Let's go and have a look at that. Because here we are back in the days of Gideon. Judges chapter 7 verse 12 describes for us the extent of the Midianite host. And we're told there that the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the children of the east lay along in the valley like grasshoppers for multitude, and their camels were without number as the sand by the seashore for multitude. And now Saul is faced with a host of Philistines every bit as great as the Midianite host. You know what God's really saying in the 1 Samuel chapter 13? He says, so you want to be Gideon, do you? All right then, let's see how you get on. And you know, if while we're there in Judges, we're told in Judges chapter 6 and verse 2, that because of the influence of the Midianites, it says the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel, and because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them dens which are in mountains and caves and strongholds. They all disappeared into the holes, brothers and sisters. And that's exactly what the 1 Samuel chapter 13 verse 6 says they did in the days of Saul. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, they did hide themselves in caves and thickets and rocks and high places and pits. 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 6. So you see, what happens is, Saul, who models himself on Gideon, suddenly finds that God brings against them a host every bit the size of the Midianites and says, let's see then whether you've learnt the spirit of Gideon or no. And he numbers his men, does Saul. And remember how many men he had with him? 600. Says the 1 Samuel chapter 14 verse 2. God says, that ought to be enough. Twice as many as Gideon had. But he can't do it, can he? Because he never understood the secret of Gideon's success. But Jonathan had. And Jonathan, in the 1 Samuel chapter 14, is the one who takes up the spirit of Gideon and who brings together that marvellous victory after his predecessor from the book of Judges. Now let's have a look then at the example of Gideon. We're told in Judges chapter 7, verse 11, then he, that is Gideon, went down with Phurah his servant unto the outside of the armed men that were in the host. In Judges chapter 7, verses 4 and 7, God says to Gideon, the people are yet too many. By the 300, that is the few that are left, will I save thee. In Judges chapter 6, verses 36 to 40, Gideon proposes a sign that would establish whether God would save by his hand or not, the sign of the fleece. In Judges 7, verse 23, it says that the men of Israel, as a result of Gideon's victory, gathered themselves together and pursued after the Midianites. And in Judges 7, verse 22, we're told specifically that Yahweh set every man's sword against his fellow. Now, did you see those connections in the 1st of Samuel, chapter 14? Let's just trace them through. In the 6th verse, we're told that Jonathan said to the young man that bear his armour, "Come and let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised." And he goes down to the host with his servant, just like Gideon. In chapter 14, verse 6 again, he says, "Yahweh will work for us, for there's no restraint to Yahweh to save by many or by few." I wonder what Jonathan had in mind when he used that particular phrase. Or who he had in mind. In the 1st of Samuel chapter 14 verses 8 to 10, a sign is proposed by Jonathan that would establish whether God would save by his hand. I wonder what prompted Jonathan to set forth a sign in such a way. He'd understood Gideon's life, hadn't he? And as a result of his faithfulness, we're told in the 1st of Samuel chapter 14 and verse 20, "And Saul and all the people that were with him assembled themselves, and they came to the battle, and one man's faith inspired many others to heights." And in the 1st of Samuel chapter 14 and verse 20, we're told in that battle, "And behold, every man's sword was against his fellow." So Saul's the one who models himself on Gideon. But Jonathan is the one who understood the secret of Gideon's life and who took up the spirit of that man to win the signal victory of the 1st of Samuel, chapter 14. And you know what the secret of Gideon's life was? The secret of Gideon's life, brothers and sisters and young people, was that he believed that God could do it. But he didn't believe he could. He was a tremendously timid man, Gideon. And he was humble enough, finally, to be empty enough of self to believe that although he couldn't do it, God could. And Saul was never, never, ever of sufficient humility of spirit to be empty enough of self to rest in God's power to say. And that was the key to Gideon's life. He was a timid man, but at least he was empty enough of self to rest in God. And when he finally learned to do that, God gave him a wonderful victory. And Jonathan understood that principle. And Jonathan had sufficient humility of spirit to copy Gideon on that occasion and to win a signal victory in the same manner. And God blessed him in the same way. Well, then that's the man, brothers and sisters and young people, that we're going to come across in the balance of our studies. He's an astonishing man, really. He's the greatest warrior in Israel. There's nobody in the land to touch him. He's got the most faith, the most courage, and probably the greatest humility of spirit, and he's been passed over for another man. And he's got to get to grips with that. And learn to accept it. And he does. And that's the story of our studies that are yet to come, when we consider the life of this man whose love truly was wonderful. Well then, what's the lessons of our brief consideration this evening from Jonathan the warrior? Trial and despair can be overcome by faithful resolution, but not ever by the mere observance of mechanical ritual. Yahweh's presence does dwell amidst his own people, and not among the uncircumcised of this world. We ought never to forget that, brothers and sisters, young people. Whenever we feel threatened by those outside, they are only the uncircumcised. Faithful courage rests in the conviction of God's ability to fight for the truth. Indeed, despite overwhelming odds, Yahweh can seal personal endeavour with divine victory. Jonathan's dedication and his enthusiasm influenced the whole ecclesia for good and inspired many to stand for the truth. Being empty of self will best enable us to rest in Yahweh's power to save. They're good lessons, aren't they? And they spring from this chapter as we open our considerations this night to the theme of Jonathan the warrior, his faithful courage, and the divine victory that followed.